Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Think just for a second about what it would mean to live life as someone from the opposite gender. Now imagine what it would mean to do this in a place like Afghanistan, where the opportunities and rights of men and women are dramatically different. In fact, this does occur relatively frequently in Afghanistan, where it's not uncommon for families to dress a girl child as a boy and raise her as a son. This phenomenon is known as Basha Posh, and it's been around for a century or so. There are a number of causes for this, and the reasons aren't all what you might expect. Today on Global Journalist, we're going to look at women's rights in Afghanistan, and to kick things off, we're going to talk about this most unusual aspect to gender relations there. Joining us first from Potomac, Maryland, to talk about Basha Posh is the Afghan-American author Nadia Hashimi. Her recent novel, The Pearl That Broke Its Shell, tells the story of two Afghan girls who dress as boys during two different periods of Afghan history. Nadia, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thanks so much.
Tell us just a little bit about Basha Posh. Why do some Afghan families choose to dress their daughters as a son and raise them as a son?
You know, it's an interesting custom when you look at it through a non-Afghan lens. But a lot of families may choose to engage in the custom for the reason that there is a superstitious belief in Afghanistan that should you be lacking a son in your family, and should you dress one of your daughters as a son, then the next child born into the family will be a real boy and will then restore that family honor that is missing. And so a lot of families may engage in the practice for that superstitious belief and trying to fill that hole.
And what ages are the girls when they are transitioned to being sons?
So there are no hard and fast rules about the Basha Posh practice. But in general, this is something that's done with a young child. And we do that because when you take a look at the practice, what happens to that child is that that girl is then reintroduced to society as the boy, and she has all the liberties afforded to a boy in Afghan society. She's therefore allowed to be more visible in public and run through the streets and do the things that a boy can naturally do, where a girl is supposed to be more meek and demure. But past the age of puberty, this is no longer appropriate, even as a facade. And therefore, this is a practice that families will engage for during the prepubescent age for a child.
And if I understand correctly, this is something that your own extended family has practiced in the past. What are the stories of some of your family members? What do you know about what it's like to live as Basha Posh?
So there have been a myriad of different kinds of experiences, and a lot of it really centers on not just what that personal experience is for the girl, but what the family around them, what kind of environment they create about being a boy versus being a girl. And so for some of these girls, the transition has been transition back to being a girl or a woman has been a relatively fluid one and a seamless one, where they're able to meld back into that female role and then, you know, go on through their lives without really much of a hiccup. But, you know, to what extent this experience is living in a boy's clothing and in a boy's persona has given them a different self confidence that they might not otherwise have had is another thing. I know of one girl who actually chose to be returned to girlhood. And so she felt an innate sense that she was a female and wanted to be restored to her natural gender. So there's a whole wide spectrum on how children accept this.
And you spoke about this transition that the girl will go through after she's been raised and lived as a boy for a period of time, and then at adolescence she transitions back to being a girl. But in some ways this must be difficult, given that boys and men in Afghanistan have many more opportunities and rights than women do.
Absolutely. And it is that discrepancy, it's that grade difference between the two genders that makes the Basha Posh such an incredible vehicle to talk about what the gender differences are in a patriarchal society like Afghanistan. Now, this doesn't cut across the board for all families. There are definitely instances where there are lots of families that treat their sons and their daughters equally and afford them both the same opportunities. But, you know, that being said, it is a society that is a bit more traditional, and there is a patriarchy that a lot of girls are up against. So for some of these girls, returning back to that second-class citizen status is a jarring experience and not a pleasant one. And a lot of these girls wish that they could stay as Basha Posh further into their lives.
So in other words, for some girls in certain situations, there's actually a benefit to this then?
It may be a benefit, but a temporary one. And, you know, the only hope that we can kind of derive from this is that during that time that they live as boys, that they're able to learn that their potential is not defined by their gender, that they have far more within them that they that they're able to achieve.
And people in the West obviously think of gender relations in Afghanistan as being very rigid. Is there something taboo if a girl is found out to be dressing as a boy there? Is it looked down upon? How does the sort of rest of the community view someone living like this?
It's certainly frowned upon when that girl is dressing as a boy past the age of puberty, because at that point, gender really takes on a whole other meaning, and that is a girl who is very close to, if not of, marriageable age. And therefore, it's no longer appropriate to be crossing those lines.
But prior to this, then, is it that people turn a blind eye to it, or that people don't even know if a child is a girl or a boy to begin with?
Some people out in public may not realize that that child is actually a boy. The transformation may be striking enough, and especially in a prepubescent child where those secondary characteristics have not yet developed. But in general, since this is a practice that's gone on for at least a century and gone on with enough frequency that nearly every Afghan who's growing up and living in Afghanistan has a one degree of separation from a Bachpush, there is a bit of, there's a tolerance for it. There is a turning the blind eye. It's something that is accepted.
And you talk about this as a practice that's gone on for a century. What do we know about how it began?
It's hard to say. In the research that I did for putting together my novel, a couple of places I found that it may have come about for practical purposes during times of war where there were not enough men and young older boys to fight in battles, that women or the older girls would then take on those roles as well, but they would do it under the guise of being a boy or a man. And so at some times, I think there's an element of practicality for the blurring of genders.
And is this something that you only see in sort of like very remote regions of Afghanistan, or is this something that takes place even in Kabul?
So interestingly, it cuts across socioeconomic lines. And for the most part, my family, my husband's family, our extended families have grown up and were living in Kabul. And they all know of one, at least one, Bachpush within their worlds and in their networks. And so it's definitely happening in the cities as much or to some extent as well as in the countryside.
And gender relations in Afghanistan have gone through some fairly significant changes over the last 40 or 50 years. Is this practice of Bachpush, is this something that you see continuing 10, 20, 30 years from now?
I don't think so. I think as Afghanistan edges its way to a more progressive society and we start to see that the rights that women in Afghanistan are fighting for, and the women in Afghanistan really are advocating for themselves, they're pushing for themselves, they're doing the work for gender equality. And I think as that moves forward and as the value of a daughter is deemed different than it is currently, once daughters start to be on equal footing as sons, then the room for the Bachpush custom will sort of disappear. The role for it will disappear.
Nadia Hashimi, thanks so much for joining us on Global Journalist.
Thanks so much for having me.
A reminder to everyone, you're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week, we're talking about women's rights in Afghanistan. Under the Taliban, of course, women were forced to wear the burqa and were banned from working outside the home or going to school. They couldn't even see a male doctor or appear in public without a male relative. Now, that has changed some over the past decade, though Afghanistan still remains one of the most restrictive places on earth for women. Joining us now to talk more about how women's lives are changing in Afghanistan, from Washington, D.C., Lael Mohib. She's a founder of the Enabled Children Initiative, an aid group that helps disabled and abandoned children in the country. She's also the spouse of Afghanistan's ambassador to the United States. Also in Washington is Nurjahan Akbar, a rights activist who founded the group Free Women Writers, which focuses on gender equality and social justice in Afghanistan. And from Vancouver, British Columbia, Lauren Oates, an aid worker and women's rights activist who has consulted on these issues for groups like UNICEF, the Women and Children's Legal Research Foundation, and USAID. Welcome to all of you. Lael Mohib, let me start with you. Give us, if you would, just a sense as to how things have changed for women in Afghanistan over the past 10 years.
Thank you for having me on the show, Jason. And I just want to pick up on the last point that Nadia made, because things really are changing. I think the country is going through a time of transformation, not just in terms of building state institutions and reforming those institutions, but culturally and socially as well. We've come a long way since the Taliban regime. It's a totally different place for women. In the 2014 elections, 40% of the voters were women. 40% of the 9 million children in school are girls. We have an incredibly dedicated president who is dedicated to advancing women's rights and has a new women's empowerment agenda with exciting new programming and policies that are designed to elevate women's status and bring them into the workforce and bring them into the economy. Just a couple examples of that change are the new women's public university, the first in the country, the president's initiative to put a woman on the Supreme Court. There are lots of changes, and it's an exciting time in the country. So I think those are some of the key areas.
Well, let me turn this to Lauren Oates. Then you've been involved in working on women's rights in Afghanistan since you were a teenager. How would you describe the changes?
I agree absolutely with that. It's just been incredibly dramatic in the time that I've been in the country and traveling back and forth, which is 13 years now. It's difficult to describe in a short period what a transformation has occurred in the country. My great concern, though, is the gap between sort of what's happening on the ground in Afghanistan and that what we in the West see. As someone who kind of commutes between one side of the world and the other and sees what's going on and all the progress, and then you come back here and you see the media coverage, which I think tends to report on events, right? Like explosions, kidnappings, acts of violence, the story of Farkhunda you referred to earlier, and doesn't really tell the story of process. And social change and economic change, those are processes and they're more complex stories to tell. And I think that's really been missing in the narrative of women's rights in Afghanistan that we hear in the West. And I work in the education sector, and as just one example, the progress there has been incredibly dramatic. If you look at the numbers, from zero girls enrolled in schools during the Taliban era, there were maybe 100,000 in clandestine schools, but none in public schools. To millions now, 3.5 to 4 million teacher colleges in every province of the country, and record numbers of girls graduating from high school and going on to university. That said, there's still lots of challenges, and that's to be expected. I think we have to sort of take into consideration what this country arose from, what the Taliban era was actually like. And back then, in those days when we were advocating for women's rights, we used the term gendercide, because women were actually dying as a result of the policies of the Taliban. This was really a hell on earth for really all Afghan people, but especially for women and girls. And things could only go up from there. There has been a lot of progress, but it does take time to recover from that kind of devastating human rights crisis and really a life and death situation for women. So, we have to be patient and we have to applaud the progress that has happened, as well as brace ourselves for all the work that still needs to be done. I mentioned some of those quantitative indicators of success. Now we need to look at the qualitative, right? Like, what is the actual quality of learning going on in schools? And I think that's where the focus needs to be now, on the quality of education and improving that for girls as well as for boys.
And let me turn this to Noor Jahan Akbar. We heard Lauren Oates and Lael Mohib talking about the progress in Afghanistan over the past 10 years or so. For women, you're an activist. Tell us about the role of women in this change. How easy is it for women to sort of stand up and demand new rights within society? Do they face harassment or threats for doing so?
Absolutely. I think as amazing as these accomplishments are, a lot of Afghan women I've worked with, a lot of Afghan women I know and I work with on a daily basis, including myself, are hesitant to celebrate these accomplishments because we don't know if they're going to stay. With increased Taliban presence in parts of the country, for example, in Helmand in the south and in the north now, which is something new for our country, I think more and more women activists are afraid for their lives, and they're afraid that our work, that the work that we have done over the past 16 years, the great work that Lael and Lauren mentioned, is in danger now because of increased militarism, increased radicalism across the countries. And, you know, it's these fears are based on truth. Activists are targeted. They do get threats. Every single woman I know who works in the public sphere in a outspoken way has been targeted and threatened at least once. So there's a real reason for these threats. So I think from now on, in order to ensure that these changes remain intact, that this progress is protected, we have to ensure that women who are fighting for the progress are also protected, that women who are fighting for this progress are not afraid for their lives on a daily basis.
And Lael Mohib, I wanted to ask you about the legal climate for women in Afghanistan. Now, the current government has received some criticism for not doing enough to prosecute crimes against women like rape or domestic violence or forced underage marriage. What's your view on this?
The laws have changed, and they've drastically improved for women. And we not only have the Elimination of Violence Against Women law, but we have, for example, a new anti-sexual harassment law that was recently passed that is designed to protect women in public space. The President Ghani, asked the Supreme Court to look into and overturn a ruling of one of the constitutional articles that judges were using to imprison women from running away from home, and that is now illegal. The laws are changing. The climate is getting better for women, but it's an implementation problem. Implementation is a challenge because of endemic corruption, which the government is also battling, but will take time to completely root out. Insecurity, some of the remote areas of the country are not reached by rule of law currently because of insecurity. So I think all the right steps are being taken. And as Lauren said, we have to be patient and we have to be thankful that there is a government in place that is changing the climate for women and making things better for them. Implementation is happening on more slowly.
I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We're talking about women's rights in Afghanistan today. We're joined by Lael Mohib, a founder of the Enabled Children Initiative, by Nurjahan Akbar of the Free Women Writers Project, and Lauren Oates, a women's rights activist and aid worker with extensive experience in Afghanistan. If you're interested in more Global Journalist content, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read our ongoing series of interviews with journalists in exile around the world and coverage of foreign affairs and press freedom issues. We're also on social media. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Global Journ. Lauren Oates, I want to ask you about one specific case that you raised earlier, that of Farkunda Malikzada. Now, she, for those of you who may not have seen the news story, was a 27-year-old woman in Kabul who was falsely accused of burning a Quran and was beaten to death by just a huge mob of men. Her body was dragged behind a car and then burned. And there are just absolutely horrific videos of this incident online because people recorded it with their smartphones. Tell us just a little bit about this case. Is it an outlier or is it something that's symptomatic of sort of the limits of progress that can be made in the current environment?
Yeah, the case of Farkunda is fascinating as well as tragic, but fascinating for many reasons in that it was an outlier to the extent that it got so much coverage and it prompted this discussion in the country. That was really a badly needed conversation on many fronts, on the role of women, on the role of religion in the public sphere, on violence against women. It just happened that all these conditions came together and that this was exposed, that this was taped by the perpetrators and by the witnesses who didn't intervene, including police who failed to intervene, and somehow made it beyond the Afghan media and into the international media and prompted outrage. And, you know, we can focus on the tragedy of Farkunda, and I think that it's very necessary to memorialize what's happened to her. In fact, there's a monument at the spot where she died in Kabul. There's been continuing protests and media coverage of the issue. But also, you know, the kind of silver lining of this was that it for a brief period, it opened up this space to talk about violence against women. And I think it's a good sort of window onto the Afghanistan of today, where there's a lot of discussion and discourse on problems, and it looks like the problems are getting worse because of all this discussion and talk about it. but in fact, it's a kind of new era when this conversation can actually take place. And violence against women is a prime example. So you now have violence against women being discussed in the media. You have people openly speaking about it, whereas once it was taboo. It was still occurring, and probably at worse or as bad scales as it is now. But it was totally under the rug, certainly under the Taliban and for the initial years after. Whereas now it's coming out into society, and you hear a lot of actually sensationalist coverage of domestic violence cases, where there's been some very extreme cases that dominated the news in Afghanistan for a long time. There's actually a television show called The Mask that's all about domestic violence, where a woman wears a mask while she describes her experience of domestic violence. And so it sort of looks like the situation is worse, that there's so much violence, but it's actually being discussed for the first time, and this is the first step. There's a lot of work to do, but at least now it's less taboo and we're talking about it and the media is addressing it and the government is addressing it as well. And so we have some new laws on paper. Now the hard work of actually taking the laws on paper and putting them into practice must begin. And that needs everyone. It needs the media, it needs the policymakers, it needs the activists and every level of government, and it needs men. And this is a really important part of the discussion. And when the incident happened with Farkhunda, what amazed me was was the reaction I saw from so many men in personal correspondence, on social media, of Afghan men saying, "I am so ashamed that this happened in my country. I know what this makes Afghanistan look like to the world. This is not the direction we want to be going in." There was a very deep, deep sense of shame among many men, and outrage as well. And for a brief moment, you could sort of say more than you could normally about the role of religion in society, about gender, about women's rights. And the challenge now is to keep that conversation going and draw a positive legacy out of the tragedy of Farkhunda's story.
And Nurjahan Akbar, I want to ask you about another well-publicized case, and that is of a 14-year-old girl, a pregnant girl named Zahra Azam, who was tortured and burned to death by her in-laws for eloping with her husband's cousin. How much traction do you think protests about this kind of violence are getting in Afghanistan today?
Protests only go so far. I think we need to think about the roots of these cases of violence. And often the root is child marriage, an early enforced marriage. This is an area that our law improve a little. For example, in Afghanistan, marriage under the age of 18 for girls is permitted, which then early marriage makes women more vulnerable to violence in their new families because they're young, they haven't finish their schooling, they are not economically independent, and when women are not economically independent, they're more likely to continue facing violence and not seek a way out of it. The story of Zahra is a great example of how a terrible example of how our justice system failed this girl from the beginning, from the day that she was married too early. Her parents, her father participated in selling her off in marriage, and that is a crime. But now he's being touted as this defender of his child's rights, even though he was the person who sold his daughter in marriage before she was 18 without her consent, that then led to this kind of violence. And when we talk about laws and changing laws and activists participating in changing laws, we have to be really critical of the progress we have made in the legal field. Yes, we have made some progress, but even today, custody laws favor men against mothers in Afghanistan. So one of the reasons women stay in violent marriages, like the one that Zahra was in, is because they don't have custody over their children after the children are over 7 years old. In fact, in Afghanistan, 10 male family members of the family of the husband have custody before the woman, even if the woman can prove that she has faced violence at home. Women stay in violent relationships and violent marriages because they know that the law will not side with them, because they know that the Elimination of Violence Against Women Act is rarely implemented in Afghanistan. It's rarely even used by judges. Judges have spoken on TV about how they disagree with the law of the country, about how they see this law as un-Islamic, even though it has nothing un-Islamic in it. So I think the story of Farkhunda and Zahra and the failure of the legal system is really a warning to Afghan women. It's telling us this could happen to you in broad daylight in the middle of the street. You could be killed by a mob and still you shouldn't expect justice.
Nurjahan, let me just actually turn that point because it's an interesting one. I want to raise it with Leo Mohib now as well, and that's the durability of some of the gains that have been made. At some point, the U.S. is going to withdraw forces from Afghanistan and other foreign countries will as well. And certainly the international community has begun disengaging from there. How durable do you see that the gains women have made in the country are, and will they be sustained in the absence of these foreign aid programs and even the foreign troops that are there?
Well, I'm optimistic, but I just want to point out that there is an assumption or a trend in international media coverage of women's rights issues that the international community being present in Afghanistan in some way forces the Afghan government and the Afghan people to honor women's rights and to progress women's rights. But I think that's a false notion. I think that the women's empowerment agenda is very much Afghan-led, not just by the government, but by young people such as Noorjahan, who's an activist, and thousands of other young people like her. It is led by the government. It is led by civil society. It is something that, as Lauren pointed out, that Afghans know is a problem in their country. There's no denial of that, and they're working to change it. So the presence of the international community is very important for many reasons, including working together with them in partnership on an Afghan-led women's empowerment agenda. But the presence or the absence of the international community, I don't think, dictates whether Afghans care about women's rights or not. I think that's false to assume.
And Lauren Oates, I'd be interested in your take on that, as well as just your experience as a foreign woman in Afghanistan. Do you receive better or worse treatment in the street or in social situations? Are you treated similarly to Afghan women?
It's a difficult question to answer because Afghanistan is an incredibly diverse country for being a geographically small country. You know, it has over 50 languages. It has two sects of Islam. You have Sunnis and Shias and a plethora of ethnic groups. And so the rules are different from province to province and sometimes from district to district. I find, you know, certainly there's places women can't access and can't go. But there's also places foreign women can access that, say, foreign men can't go. And I think I've had a greater degree of interaction with Afghans of all walks of life and in rural areas and urban areas of life because I'm a woman, because I can go into private houses, I can talk to Afghan women, I can learn about their lives. I'm not stuck behind compound walls in a kind of in a bubble. And certainly I faced hostility, I faced harassment. Luckily, I can't understand everything that's been said to me. My diary is a work in progress. You know, it really depends where you are. And there's always been a big division between the urban and rural areas of the country, with Kabul as kind of the cosmopolitan heart of Afghanistan, where you see all kinds of diverse practices, the bacha posh and different roles for women, and it's a little bit easier to move around there. Whereas if you go to, say, the deep south, to rural Kandahar, you will have to dress differently and behave differently and observe a different set of rules. So it's a constant kind of navigation of the cultural landscape, and it's fascinating and fun.
I'm sorry, Lauren, we're just about out of time. We're going to have to leave it there for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Missouri School of Journalism. Many thanks to Nadia Hashimi, Lael Mohib, Noorjahan Akbar, and Lauren Oates for joining us. Our executive producer is Josh Kranzberg. Our producers this week are Jinhong Chen and Javila Ruska-Skate. Our studio director is Travis McMillan of the Reynolds Journalism Institute. And our audio engineer is Pat Akers of KBIA. For all of us here at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.